On today's episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, we're going to be talking about whether you should have multiple websites for multiple products and some ways to generate residual income. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 87. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes that we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
I have completed the code merge that was giving me absolute nightmares last week.
Oh, the merge? So to give listeners a little background, you had a couple developers working and like they would both check in code and it would conflict.
Yeah.
Is that right? And you would have to do manual merging. Why wasn't Subversion or Git handling that?
It's because it was the Visual Studio's .designer files, which Microsoft, for some reason, decides that they're going to reorder things when they go back into the designer file. So if you two different people make changes, you're not guaranteed that the changes in each of those files are going to be in the same places. And because it's kind of an auto-generated file, there's not much you can do about it. So I actually wrote a utility that would sort the contents of the file and make it so that it was a lot easier to merge.
How interesting. Yeah, I never ran into that. I think when I was on big teams doing .NET development, we used Vault, or we did use Perforce, but we had the lock file checked so that if you check something out, it was locked to avoid this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so two people couldn't edit a file at the same time. And maybe that's why they did it at those companies.
It could be. It could just be the type of file, too. I mean, because everything else merged fine. It was just a couple of .designer files and a couple of .resx files. And, I found a utility that would sort the resx file, so it was a lot easier to manage. But the .designer file, I couldn't find a utility for that, so I wrote one. It took me probably 2 or 3 hours to write it, whereas going through by hand, I probably spent 6 or 8 hours before I just kind of gave up. Oof. And turned to writing code.
Yeah, that's brutal. Well, I guess it's been about 3.5 weeks now. I launched the article feature, one-click articles on Hittail, and it's continuing to do well. I finally sent out an email to all the paying customers. Before that, I basically just had a splash screen when people logged in that they would see new, articles were available. But about a week ago, I finally sent an email to everybody who's paying, and they, it continued to ramp up. So I think we've done over 60 articles in like 25 days. So it's been a nice pace, and as a result, the lifetime value of my customers has, assuming this pace keeps up, it has increased quite a bit. So it's definitely been, the entire goal really is to increase the lifetime value so I have more leeway when acquiring customers, that I can do more creative things and some things that are a little more expensive. So it's been a good experiment. We have had three kind of returns. One, we were able to fix. My admin fixed it himself. And then actually the other one he fixed as well. There was only one where we gave someone's money back or we asked for a kind of a rewrite. That's what we're going to do, is have 100% money back guarantee on the article quality. So I actually, to be honest, I expected by the time we get to 60 articles that there would have been a lot more just manual labor, like trouble, support issues, people not liking the articles, or just different things that have happened. And so far, it's just been a kind of a walk in the park. I'm knocking on wood right now because I don't want to jinx it. But so far, I'm really happy with the level of effort we've had to expand versus the revenue that we've received from this feature.
You kind of did a soft launch with it too, right? I mean, it's not like you just blasted it out to everybody and said, hey, here's this brand new feature that we think you're going to love.
That's true. Yeah, the soft launch was just the splash screen. And so it was very slow going because only 30 to 50 people log in a day. And so some trickled in for several days. And you're right, I did fix several issues during that time. And so by the time I emailed, it was close to 1,000 people. That really helped that I had fixed those things, that I hadn't just done the big launch without tweaking it first.
Cool. I think that by the time we record the next podcast, I'm going to have a definitive date for when I'll be starting my closed beta for Audit Shark.
I love it. So that'll be next week. We'll have a countdown timer, mikestimeline.com, and it'll be a JavaScript countdown timer. I like the idea.
Isn't there some website where you go there and you have to pledge something, or you give them a picture of you from high school and you have to meet your launch date? And if you don't meet it, they tweet it out and email it out to all your friends and family.
I like this. If you know that URL, someone send it to me.
About the only other thing is, I think along with my launch date, I'll at least know what the date is, but I'm definitely going to start my closed beta program on that date, and then I'll probably give myself maybe 4 or 6 weeks to give myself time to get some feedback from people, talk to people, and get some of the different bugs and stuff fixed. But I'm feeling good about it. I mean, things on the back end are starting to really come together with the code merge that I did, and the guys have been making really good progress on the back end code, and it's just been more of a, I'll say that I feel like more like a project manager than actually a developer at this point.
Right. And when you're tight on time, sometimes that's the best way to be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've switched over to 4x10-hour days for my consulting work for the next month or so. So that'll give me an extra day every week to work on stuff. And I'm still working on things in the evenings to get everything done. But so far, things are progressing nicely.
Nice. 4x10s. That's a nice schedule. All right, so shall we dive into our first question?
Yeah, what do we got on deck?
Our first one is from Andrew, and he says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I'm in the process of launching my first SaaS product, and the help you guys give on the podcast has been invaluable. While researching and developing my app, I came across another product opportunity in the same niche. I've already coded the second product, and it's ready for launch. I want to launch this product now with the goal of bringing in some cash as well as building another source of potential customers while I finish coding my original idea. My question is whether I should launch this as a standalone product with its own website or as part of a suite of products that would eventually include both applications. There will be a big crossover in the original content I can create and blog around the two products, so from a marketing standpoint, I'm leaning towards the latter approach, which is the single site that has two products. What are the advantages and disadvantages you can see for each approach?"
I think it's a tough question. I'm not real sure which direction I would go with this, but I think that I might lean more towards one site and then kind of split it into a couple of different subdirectories. And that would be more for, I think, technical reasons than anything else. It probably would also give you a little bit more credibility in the website itself, because it is a new product, and credibility is one of those things that is, I think, a little difficult to establish early on. But if you have two different products with different marketing material around them on the same website, then it tends to lend credibility to the website itself. If you have your own website that is essentially forming social proof for the website, but at the same time, it can work because you do have the two products there. And if people look at your website and they see that you have two products, they say, "Oh, this company is legitimate. They have a legitimate product. They have, you know, legitimate customers, presumably." And it does reinforce that a little bit. But I also wonder how difficult it's going to be to do both of them at the same time, because I'll be honest, I mean, I'm in the middle of doing multiple things at the same time, and it is very, very difficult. So I think my advice would probably be to start with one product on the site and build it for just the one product, and then integrate the second one into it when you're ready. I don't think that trying to do both at the exact same time is probably the way to go on this one.
Yep, I agree with that last part. I think trying to do multiple products is the kiss of death. I think the only way you can do multiple at once is if they're like information products and you don't have the support and adding features and all that stuff to go with it. You can kind of write it like an ebook or something, or screencast. You can build it and then it's done, and you know, you don't really need to put a bunch of time into it. Yeah, I do think it's definitely a mistake to try to do both at once. And I also would agree that you want to get one of them out there, get it marketed, get, you know, get the blogging going, get the SEO going, get whatever other channels you have going, and then introduce the second one to add a later time once you feel like you know the market better. I'm really hesitant to put two products on one website. And there's a bunch of reasons why, but I think the most prominent one is that there's a lack of focus. Anytime I come to a website and it's trying to sell me multiple things, it doesn't do a very good job at any of them. So as an example, Mike, you and I basically have kind of a suite of products, if you think about it. We have the podcast, we have a conference, MicroConf, I have a book that's related to the same genre, we have the Academy. These things are all related, right? So in theory, you could say, well, they lend credibility to each other, so we could just have a single landing page that's like the micropreneur landing page, and then have a drop-down list, or have four things in the top nav, and have conference, book, you know, online startup school, and podcast. But when you think about that, it doesn't lend itself to a lot of things. Number one, it doesn't lend itself to SEO very well, because the content is not highly focused, and Google likes small articles that are focused. And the other thing is it overwhelms people. When they arrive at the website, there's too many decisions, too many choices, and people often wind up just doing nothing. There's too many paths to follow. What I would recommend, if it's at all possible, is to create basically a chain or a long funnel. And so you figure out which of these products is lower cost and which of them people are more likely to buy first. And then you set up a website for that and you market the crap out of that and you get, you know, people to buy the product, you support the product, you provide way more value than people pay for. And now you have these paying customers. And now, just like we do with the podcast and just like we do with MicroConf and the Academy and the book, it's like you can kind of start tying them together and you can say, hey, since you bought this, I provide quality stuff. You have the experience. You know that I take care of you. And now here, look at this other thing I created that's equally as good and it's in a similar niche. So I almost see it as a more of a back-end product. So you're doing them in serial rather than trying to market them in parallel.
I think one of the situations where I could see this working really well is if the products are, you know, if one of the products is actually a plug-in for the other product or there's huge integrations between them. But as you said, I mean, you need to start somewhere. I mean, even with something like, you know, the products from 37 Signals, you know, you look at the marketing material for them and they're really on their own. And it's only until you get into them and you start using them that you see that there's additional integration points in them and that you can sort of leverage data between them and kind of stay in one interface. It's pretty well hidden, I'll say. But I definitely agree with what you said, that trying to separate them, and if they are in the same niche market, trying to figure out which one people are going to buy first and then use the second product as essentially an upsell from the first.
All right. Hope that helps. Thanks for the question, Andrew. Our second question today is from Ryan Higgins, and he's asking about top performing residual income generators. He says, hey guys, I really dig your show, appreciate all of the grassroots tips, and have employed many in my online work. Over the past 3 years, I've had success selling professional services online, but I find this time consuming and often very demanding as I promise response to online clients within 24 hours of receiving their emails. I've also created modest revenue through AdSense ads and downloadable ebooks I've written on various subjects. To be honest, I much prefer this latter business platform as it seems to run automatically whether I tend to it or not, unlike the online services part of my work. So obviously he's talking about products versus services, right? It's consulting dollars for hours versus building a product that's much more leverageable. So my question is, what are some other creative ways you've seen people generate self-regulating income online? Keep up the great work. Ryan, a Canadian in Shanghai. I'll take a crack at this one first. So Ryan's basically asking about, you know, other ways that he can monetize his knowledge, monetize his experience, but not just trade dollars for hours. And obviously there's a big challenge up front when you're trying to build products. It's that you need to find out products that people need or want, and you have to spend the time to do it. And there's a risk that they may not buy. And that's where, you know, consulting is such an easier road, because you can just have someone pay you X dollars for a certain amount of hours and you just kind of cash it in upfront. But on the flip side, that doesn't scale at all. It's not leverageable over time. It's not a way to really build a sustainable business. And so I guess Ryan's looking for other creative ways for people to generate online income. And I mean, that's basically what like this entire podcast is about, and kind of what the Lifestyle Business Podcast and Smart Passive Income and Foolish Adventure. I mean, I would listen to all of those podcasts. It's basically about taking your expertise and starting blogs, podcasts, writing ebooks, building software, providing value in a productized form that, you know, helps people get what they need done. And I mean, you can see this all over the place. I think maybe the best example I'll bring up is like Foolish Adventure. If you've never listened to that podcast, Tim Conley has this thing called the three product approach. And it involves having a free product, and that's typically a blog or a podcast that you're giving away for free. And then your second product is also free, but you ask for an email address. So that's where you build your newsletter up. And then your third product is when you sell. So that's typically like maybe an ebook. Sometimes it can be a membership site. And that's his flow. And he kind of came up with that concept. I think it's really good. So, I mean, that's one way to do it. I think that's a creative way. But I think, you know, there's certainly other ways. Mike and I throw a conference, and it's not, you know, a massive revenue generating thing, but it is something that raises our profile and is fun to do. And it does make some money now. So that could be a creative way. Obviously, writing ebooks, writing physical books, like I did, you know, paperback books, and starting online membership websites are all great ways. And if you have desire and you have experience in software, then that's, of course, what we, you know, that's something that Mike and I focus a lot on this podcast, is building apps, building plugins, building something of value. I mean, we know a number of entrepreneurs who've seen a lot of success in the Micropreneur Academy, building WordPress plugins for folks for in all types of niches, building SaaS applications, building desktop applications, building mobile apps, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I hope that gives you some starting points.
One of the things that you mentioned kind of in passing was something I was going to bring up, which is membership sites. And it sounds to me like what you'd said was, I've created some modest revenue through AdSense ads and downloadable ebooks I've written on various subjects. And if those ebooks are on related subjects, then I think you could probably take a lot of that material and put it into some sort of a membership site where you're charging people, obviously, to be a monthly member of that site and provide them access to that material. But because it is a membership website, I believe that you could probably charge them significantly more than if you were to take all that information and just distribute it as an ebook. So essentially, you would be able to migrate the content from your ebook and into the membership website. And I think you want to add additional things into the membership website, not just, you know, do a direct copy from the ebook. That could significantly boost revenue for you from that particular, you know, line of products as well. The other thing I would mention is that if you've already created some sort of a modest revenue through some of these ebooks, I would look into trying to distribute them further and trying to get them out there. I mean, because it seems to me like a lot of the problems that people have with things like this is they get to the marketing stage and they don't do very well with it, and they give up too easily, and they don't necessarily find the upper bounds of where they can take something. So a lot of times they'll give up early and, you know, just not push it far enough, and they'll say, well, I need to look for a new product because this one has topped out. And the reality is it may not have topped out. You know, are you sure that it has? And so those are the things that I would definitely look into is whether or not those ebooks can be pushed further, whether you can do additional marketing around them, and increase the monthly revenue from them.
Nice. So I give generalities on this one and you give the specifics. High five.
Virtual high five.
Virtual high five. All right. Our next question is from Rasmus in Denmark. And he says, my product and question is around generating a valid amount of relevant traffic within a reasonable period of time to be able to validate my idea. I know you've briefly mentioned AdWords to buy traffic, but are there other channels or sources of relevant traffic? It would also be relevant to know more about the AdWords source, for example, volume, time span, etc., as well as what volume you see as a reasonable validity. I know about setting up AdWords campaigns and controlling keyword limits, etc. Personally, I don't have an established audience like you guys have, so how do you validate an idea if you're starting from scratch? Would love to hear a podcast allocated to this topic. All the best, Rasmus from Denmark.
So I think that the things that we've talked about previously definitely apply to this. I mean, you know, you're not going to be able to do SEO and drive a lot of traffic in a reasonable amount of time. And I'll define reasonable as in, you know, 2 to 4 weeks, something like that. Because SEO does take time. You're going to do some stuff and it's going to take Google 2 or 3 weeks just to either identify your website or to put it in the rankings. And then you're going to have to take time to figure it out what changes you need to make. And it's just, you know, a long, convoluted process. I think you're much better off trying to identify people who you want to target and then either use AdWords, Facebook ads, or Twitter advertisements to try and drive traffic to your website. And from there, obviously, a number of different methods you can use to try and figure out whether or not your idea has legs. But two that I would look at is one, seeing if they're actually clicking through to the buy now button. And another one is if you would put some sort of a survey out there and start asking people, you know, is this something you'd pay for? How much would you pay for it? Maybe put a newsletter out there. And I wouldn't do all three of these things at the same time. You know, maybe put the pricing page there, and then after they click through for pricing or through the buy now button, say, sorry, this isn't available, but sign up for our newsletter or take this survey. Or you could kind of chain them together and you have buy now button and then sign up for the newsletter, and then after that you can ask them to take a survey. But definitely don't put all three of them on the same page at the same time. You want to chain them together to get better results for that. But those are the types of things that I would look at. I know that Rob and I both have a decent number of Twitter and RSS subscribers for the podcast and our blogs and everything, but I don't see those as very big generators for at least half of the business ideas that I have. I just don't see those as legitimate ways to send traffic, mainly because it's untargeted.
Yeah, I would agree. Typically, an audience like the one we have isn't actually that great for the products we're launching. I experience very low signup rates from blog readers and Hacker News readers when I relaunched Hittail in January, and that was not unexpected. I mean, I just don't expect, a lot of people who are just getting started out to really want to pay monthly for a service that they probably can't use until down the line. So Jason Cohen experienced the same thing when he launched WP Engine. He said he got a handful of customers from his blog audience. What an audience gets you more of is it gets you the ability to partner up with people, to raise funding. It's much, much more about relationships than it is about actually, driving traffic and trying to get people to sign up for a mailing list for a product that's not related to it. I have a couple thoughts on this. The first thing is, Rasmus, you got to ask, is your audience online? Is your niche that you need to reach, are they online at all? Because if they're not, then all this online stuff we're talking about, it just isn't going to work. You're going to have to resort to more offline stuff. So if you can determine if they actually are hanging out online, I want to take a step back and say, don't just rely on driving people to landing pages and getting their email addresses. Talk to people. Like, try to meet with them in person if they're within driving distance of you. Try to get them on Skype to have a conversation. It is so much more valuable both for you and for that person if you can actually have a conversation instead of just a simple email survey or a simple email conversation even. I would say that while all this stuff that I'm going to list and that Mike talked about is good, and it's good for driving some traffic and getting an idea, getting a list that you can then contact, that's not the end goal. The end goal is actually engaging with people and having conversations. I'm going to throw out some ideas. I think the first thing you should do is look if there are any conferences within a few hundred mile radius of you that caters to this audience, and try to go to that conference so that you can meet people in person, have discussions with them, get an idea if what you're building is at all going to serve them. I would also look for forums that cater to this audience. Obviously, examples of that in our niche, since I know them because I hang out there, are things like Hacker News, and you could totally do an Ask HN if you have a product coming out, and you could post a link there, and that will bring people to a landing page. You can ask them what they think of the idea. You can go on Quora and you can either ask questions or you can answer questions. And you'll note that none of these are scalable solutions. You're never just going to turn the dial on these and bring millions of visitors, but that's not the point. At this point, you have to do things that don't scale, and it's going to take a lot of time. You either need a bunch of time or you need a bunch of money. And I'm assuming that at this point, you don't have a bunch of money. So I definitely think Quora is underused for that. I also think that creating an infographic right off the bat, you can get an infographic created, a pretty nice one for between $200 and $300. I found people both on Odesk and Elance to do that. That's a great way to drive 30,000 people to your website in 24 hours if it goes viral. And if you make it good, you make it for that niche. It's a nice way to draw a lot of traffic for a small spend. You brought up AdWords. Yes, it's the old mainstay. If you're in a tough niche at all that's competitive, you're going to pay $3 to $5 a click. So AdWords these days for me is more of a last resort, but it could be something to look into. And I think there's four other ideas I might try. One, I would look into Facebook ads since the demographic targeting is so good and that you can test a lot of ads at once. It's not a bad way to go. You can get some pretty cheap clicks there. And then StumbleUpon, you can get 10-cent clicks, but you can't just send people to a landing page. You have to send them to some content, like an engaging or viral blog post that then links over to a landing page. If you send them just to a landing page, they will bail. And then the other two Mike mentioned, actually. He mentioned Twitter ads, which I have heard some people getting some decent success. And then I guess the last one Mike didn't mention, which was buy-sell ads. And that's display advertising. You buy it a month at a time. And they have a bunch of different niches now. And you can spend as little as maybe $20. And you'll get a fairly low click-through rate because they are banner ads. But you can definitely get niche traffic from a service like that. So those are like 6 or 8 ideas kind of off the top of my head. But this, to be honest, this process right here is what I did when I was creating the Hittail marketing plan. For the months leading up to acquiring Hittail, I would sit down for 15 minutes at a time and sketch out a huge list of ways I thought that I might be able to market Hittail. And I just kept stuffing them into that doc. And over time, it became a really good corpus of all these ideas. There's about 12 pages of it. And I've been working through it since I acquired it 8 months ago. And I would recommend if you're thinking about launching your product, think about doing the same thing. Make the huge list and then start peeling off ideas and using them to send traffic to the landing page. And some of them are going to work well, and then you're going to reuse those when you get to actually launching your product. So I realize that's a lot of information, but I hope that helps, Rasmus. All right. For our fourth and final question today, we have an email about beta phase. It's from Kevin Marshall, and he says, I was wondering if you guys could speak a little bit about closed beta tests versus just letting everyone all in at the beginning. I see a lot of startup websites in a beta stage. Sometimes they even close it off at the start and require you to sign up for a request invitation. Sometimes you may get that invitation, yet often you don't. Overall, my question is, how important is it to even have this testing phase? Is a customer more turned off because they see and realize they're in a beta, or are they more turned off when they realize that a site they thought was fully polished and ready to roll is not?
I'll take a first crack at this one. I think that if you're putting together a beta and you are telling people that they have to sign up to get an invitation request and they're not actually sending those out, my inclination is to believe that they're doing something wrong. I don't know if that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good marketing tactic. I don't think that in 95% of the cases that generates any sort of anticipation or demand for the product. That's the sort of thing that Apple could pull off or Microsoft could pull off. It's not something that much smaller companies like us can do. It just doesn't work. The purpose of a beta is usually to flush out the bugs and make sure that there are no major problems that are going to be encountered by people once you open up the gates. And I think that if you're going to do a beta, I think you typically want to do some sort of a closed beta first. I don't know if having an open beta is really going to do anything for you because you're really just not getting the information that you want from people. If you have a closed beta, then you can essentially hand select those people, kind of categorize them by the type of people they are. So if you had a mailing list and you were asking people information about them before you got them onto the mailing list and you can essentially categorize those people, you might say, okay, well, I want to grab 5 people from the low-end category who would be on the lowest plan, 5 from the middle, and 5 from the top end. And you would essentially arrange it so that hopefully you can get all 5 of those in there from each of those categories. But if you can't, you go to the next person in line and the next person until you find people who are willing to actually sign up and use the product. Whether they pay for it or not is a different story. I don't know. I'd have to give a little bit of thought to that. But I also think that it depends a lot on the product itself as to whether or not you want people to try and pay for it. It depends mostly, I think, on where in the product development process you are and whether or not you're confident that there's a market for it. So part of it comes back to the purpose of the beta and what your purpose is, because different people have different reasons for running that beta. Some people, they just want to use it to, flush out any major bugs or many major process problems that are in the software. There's other people who want to use it to actually test the code because they didn't test it themselves or they aren't really sure about it. And then there's people who are trying to get people into the beta program to essentially test to make sure that they had a product that was worth selling. And if you're at that point, then it's kind of too late for that. I mean, you really should have done a lot of that legwork up front. But even if you haven't, working with people individually is going to give you a lot better feedback than if you just open up the floodgates and try and get a lot of people in. If you segment your audience into groups of 10 or 15 people, what you'll find is that all it takes is, I think the number is 12 people to individually talk to them one-on-one. And those 12 people will give you exactly what you need, which is the same as you would get from having more of an open beta from like 10 groups of 15 people, because people are going to be much more willing to give you that individual feedback that you're really looking for if you interact with them one-on-one. Whereas if you're doing something that's more like a focus group where you have a lot of people in it, they say, oh, well, I'm not going to answer this. I don't really have time. Somebody else will do it. I don't have to. So essentially your response rate plunges and you have to talk to more people. Whereas if you get down where you're talking to people one-on-one, you're individually working with these people who you've put into your beta program, you're going to get the information back that you need that is, directly relevant to the goals that you've put in place for that beta.
Yep, you nailed it with that last one. It's called the diffusion of responsibility, and it's a psychological concept that when, it's explained like when a group of people all get an email, typically most people will just not do anything with it. But if you email each person individually, then they know kind of your eye is on them, and they're much more likely to do something. I would agree with you. You're going to get far better feedback if you have a much smaller group and you deal with people individually, and you let them know that you're going to deal with them individually, and that your beta list is only 5 people, or your beta testing group is only 5 people or 10 people. If I had a list, let's say I had a launch list of 500 people, I would probably invite handpick five of them, and they would either be friends who are in the niche or acquaintances who are in this niche that I'm targeting, who are actually going to use the product and would pay for it long term. Or, you know, if I didn't have any of those, I would probably just randomly pick the top five off the list and email them in and invite them and let them know that it's a very, very small group. This allows you to do a couple things. One, it allows you to get a lot of detailed feedback because they're going to be more willing to give it to you. It also allows you to kind of burn through your beta testers. Because if you haven't run a beta before, what typically happens is you bring in a group of people and they look through the app and they look through and a lot of them find the same things. Then you go away for a week and you fix all that stuff and you improve it. Then you come back to them. And when you ask them again, they will tend to just go in for about 3 minutes and breeze through and make sure you fix the stuff they asked. And that's it. And so you kind of do, you burn through beta testers. They aren't just an unlimited resource. But if you have that list of 500, you let five in, then you email another five and you say, hey, this is like my second round of beta. You kind of do the same thing with them and you get another round of feedback until you feel like you fix the major bugs and you fix the major usability issues. So kind of to summarize, I would definitely keep it small, between 5 and 10 people each round. I would only go multiple rounds if I needed to, and I would keep the rounds as short as humanly possible. If you can do 5-day, 7-day iterations, that's what I would do. I would not do 2-month-long betas unless it was absolutely necessary. The other two points that I'll touch on is, what's nice is that if you get the beta testers in early and they like the app and you work with them one-on-one, you kind of build relationships and you build some early users, and those early users can be real champions of your product launch. Long term. If they get in, they feel like they have a little bit of ownership. They'll be the first ones, you know, when you launch, you can ask them to tweet it out, ask them to tell their friends, and they're much more likely to do it than just this blanket list of 500 people, because you've actually kind of built a kind of relationship. In terms of offering them a discount or comping, I say it would depend on how much work they actually give you. I think upfront, I would say, will you be a beta tester, spend some time, and you know, in exchange for a lifetime discount on the product? And I would just leave it at that and not specify it. And then some people are going to do so much work and give you so much value that it's going to just be worth comping them for life, period. Like I've done it in the past. It's totally a no-brainer. And then other people are going to do less work and, you know, maybe you give them 40% off or 50% off for life, assuming it's a recurring product. I think the last point, one that I didn't cover, is Kevin asked, is this phase even important to have? Should you have a beta round? And I think even, you know, as simple as this article functionality that I just wrote into Hittail was, I mean, it's really just one single feature. Even as simple as that was, I essentially had a beta phase. It was only a week or two, but I'd let a trickle of customers come in. There were absolutely bugs. There were usability issues. There were some minor things on certain browsers, but having that was invaluable for when I kind of unleashed the fire hose on it. And so, yeah, if I was launching an entire product and I'd only done some usability and unit testing and, you know, some integration testing, but I really hadn't had actual users use it, I would be concerned with mailing out to my 500-person list and letting in a horde of people who I'm trying to sell the app to. I would be concerned about doing that without having at least one round of testing and, you know, preferably if some stuff was found, going through another round until it just feels like it's clean and it feels like the app is improved. I can almost guarantee you, no matter how good the app is, no matter how good you feel it is, until you've done this round of testing and had actual users use it, you are not going to uncover probably 70% of the issues that are going to arise as soon as people start doing it.
If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.